Welcome back. We return to the synthesis of yoga. We had finished looking at the planes of our existence. Last time we come to chapter 20. On this occasion, the lower triple Purusha. Published on the 15th of July, 1917. In the Arya, this is an essay that Sri Aurobindo did not return to for any revisions. It stands as it was published then. Interestingly, the lead article that month, which closed out the third volume of the Arya, in The Life Divine, was a chapter, the second chapter, The Eternal and the Individual. There was part one the previous month, and this month it was part two. The Eternal and the Individual, and now we look at how it is that we come to identify ourselves with all the machinery of our nature, with what we seem to be in this lower triple world. Who is this person who dwells in this lower triplicity? And is it us? Do we possess this? Are we identified with it? Are we merely this? Are we not more than this? The lower triple Purusha. Such is the constituent principle of the various worlds of cosmic existence and the various planes of our being. They are as if a ladder plunging down into matter and perhaps below it, rising up into the heights of the spirit, even perhaps to the point at which existence escapes out of cosmic being into ranges of a supracosmic absolute. So at least it is averred in the world system of the Buddhists. Well, let's look at this ladder of existence. Remember, we've just come from rereading Sri Aurobindo's small but mighty book, The Mother, in which he speaks about this ladder of existence, plunging below and climbing back out. This is an image which is precious to us because Sri Aurobindo accepts all the stages of being as a hierarchical expression of what is ultimately inexpressible. But these planes of being to him are real. Plunging below into what seems to be an inconscience, a nescience, and rising back out of it, step by step, grade by grade, climbing back to what might be an absolute. He says this is a supracosmic absolute in the world system of the Buddhists, might be in the Mahayana. Sri Aurobindo would have been somewhat familiar with that. It isn't clear that he was much at all familiar with Vajrayana teachings. That would have come later. So let's keep in mind this ladder of existence. And as we think about that, go back to the Life Divine and hold with us the idea of a sevenfold cord of being from matter all the way through the suprarational regions into Satchit Ananda. Also, when we think about a ladder of being, the Sankhya system too, even though it's thought of as being merely materialistic, extends from a tree whose roots are above, shall we say, and its branches going below, from the heights of what seems to be a vast consciousness, mahas, buddhi, the source of illumination in the material world, all the way through manas and down through the senses, gross and subtle, till we reach the core body experience. All of this, too, is a hierarchy of being, a ladder of existence. He continues, but to our ordinary materialized consciousness, all this does not exist. Because it is hidden from us by our preoccupation with our existence in a little corner of the material universe, and with the petty experiences of the little hour of time, which is represented by our life in a single body upon this earth. So we are engrossed in the external world's design, to take a line from Sri Aurobindo's Savitri. And we miss all that is behind, all that is hidden to our view. And what is hidden is also occult. That's all the world word means. To that consciousness, the world is a mass of material things and forces thrown into some kind of shape and harmonized into a system of regulated movements by a number of fixed self-existent laws which we have to obey, by which we are governed and circumscribed, and of which we have to get the best knowledge we can so as to make the most of this one brief existence which begins with birth, ends with death, and has no second recurrence. This is the view of materialism. This is the physical consciousness appraising its experience in the world. Our own being is a sort of accident, or at least a very small and minor circumstance in the universal life of matter, or the eternal continuity of the workings of material force. Somehow or other, a soul or mind has come to exist in a body, and it stumbles about among things and forces which it does not very well understand, at first preoccupied with the difficulty of managing to live in a dangerous and largely hostile world, and then with the effort to understand its laws and use them so as to make life as tolerable or as happy as possible so long as it lasts. If we were really nothing more than such a minor movement of individualized mind in matter, existence would have nothing more to offer us. Its best part would be, at most, this struggle of an ephemeral intellect and will with eternal matter, and with the difficulties of life supplemented and eased by a play of imagination and by the consoling fictions presented to us by religion and art and all the wonders dreamed of by the brooding mind and restless fancy of man. Eloquently dismissing a number of the world's philosophies in a grand sweep. But because he is a soul and not merely a living body, man can never for long remain satisfied that this first view of his existence, the soul view justified by the external and objective facts of life, is the real truth or the whole knowledge. His subjective being is full of hints and inklings of realities beyond. It is open to the sense of infinity and immortality. It is easily convinced of other worlds, higher possibilities of being, larger fields of experience for the soul. And indeed, in modern psychology, this is the whole quest. How do we explain the interior dimension of our experience? How do we explain that we seem to be inside? What is this interiorization? What are these subjective modes of psychology? How is it possible? What is the nature of consciousness? Why should this inner possibility be there if all is mere materialism? Science gives us the objective truth of existence and the superficial knowledge of our physical and vital being. But we feel that there are truths beyond, which possibly, through the cultivation of our subjective being and the enlargement of its powers, may come to lie more and more open to us. When the knowledge of this world is ours, we are irresistibly impelled to seek for the knowledge of other states of existence beyond. And that is the reason why an age of strong materialism and skepticism is always followed by an age of occultism, of mystical creeds, of new religions, and profounder seekings after the infinite and the divine. So we saw in the 19th century was a time where materialism strode majestically through the streets of all cities in the world. And yet, at its peak, here came theosophy. Here came a revived Indian nationalism. Here came the possibility of a deeper view of mystical traditions efflorescing throughout Europe, bringing back to life yoga's spiritual disciplines in India that had gone into a long period of torpid slumber. He continues, the knowledge of our superficial mentality and the laws of our bodily life is not enough. It brings us always to that mysterious and hidden depth of subjective existence below and behind, of which our surface consciousness is only a fringe or an outer court. We come to see that what is present to our physical senses is only the material shell of a cosmic existence, and what is obvious in our superficial mentality is only the margin of immense continents which lie behind unexplored. To explore them must be the work of another knowledge than that of physical science or of a superficial psychology. And we have the first possibilities of such a depth psychology coming from Carl Jung, Roberto Assagioli, and others. But who is the real psychologist but the one who knows the soul? And that is the one who has fulfilled the tenets of yoga. So it is yoga which can teach us best about this world within the world. Religion is the first attempt of man to get beyond himself and beyond the obvious and material facts of his existence. So here you might want to go back to The Life Divine and read his chapter on the evolution of the spiritual man and see the role that all of these various perspectives serve in the developing human consciousness as it evolves. Its first essential work is to confirm and make real to him his subjective sense of an infinite on which his material and mental being depends, and the aspiration of his soul to come into its presence and live in contact with it. Its function is to assure him, too, of that possibility of which he has always dreamed, but of which his ordinary life gives him no assurance, the possibility of transcending himself and growing out of bodily life and mortality into the joy of immortal life and spiritual existence. Immortality defined in spirit. And again, we go back to The Life Divine, to its opening phrases. Please go back and read them again. You'll be happy when you go to sleep. You'll be happy when you wake up. It also confirms in him the sense that there are worlds or planes of existence other than that in which his lot is now cast, worlds in which this mortality and this subjection to evil and suffering are not the natural state, but rather bliss of immortality is the eternal condition. Incidentally, it gives him a rule of mortal life by which he shall prepare himself for immortality. Again, we're talking about religion here and the role that it can play in the developing spirit. He is a soul and not a body. And his earthly life is a means by which he determines the future conditions of his spiritual being. So much is common to all religions. Beyond this, we get from them no assured certainty. Their voices vary. Some tell us that one life on earth is all we have in which to determine our future existence, deny the past immortality of the soul, and assert only its future immortality. Threaten it even with the incredible dogma of a future of eternal suffering for those who miss the right path, while others, more large and rational, affirm successive existences by which the soul grows into the knowledge of the infinite with a complete assurance for all of ultimate arrival and perfection. Some present the infinite to us as a being other than ourselves, with whom we can have personal relations. Others, as an impersonal existence into which our separate being has to merge. Some, therefore, give us as our goal worlds beyond in which we dwell in the presence of the divine. Others, a cessation of world existence by emergence in the infinite. Most invite us to bear or to abandon earthly life as a trial or a temporary affliction or a vanity and fix our hopes beyond. In some, we find a vague hint of a future triumph of the spirit, the divine in the body, upon this earth, in the collective life of man, and so justify not only the separate hope and aspiration of the individual, but the united and sympathetic hope and aspiration of the race. Religion, in fact, is not knowledge, but a faith and aspiration. It is justified indeed, both by an imprecise intuitive knowledge of large spiritual truths and by the subjective experience of souls that have risen beyond the ordinary life. But in itself, it only gives us the hope and faith by which we may be induced to aspire to the intimate possession of the hidden tracts and larger realities of the spirit. So it has a sense of what must be there, and it honors those who have achieved and spoken about it and movingly communicated and conveyed it to the laity. But it isn't the same. It does, though, induce us to aspire. That we turn always the few distinct truths and symbols or the particular discipline of a religion into hard and fast dogmas is a sign that as yet we are only infants in the spiritual knowledge and are yet far from the science of the infinite. That would be avidya. Yet, behind every great religion, behind, that is to say, its exoteric side of faith, hope, symbols, scattered truths, and limiting dogmas, there is an esoteric side of inner spiritual training and illumination by which the hidden truths may be known, worked out, possessed. Behind every exoteric religion, there is an esoteric yoga, an intuitive knowledge to which its faith is the first step. Inexpressible realities of which its symbols are the figured expression. A deeper sense for its scattered truths, mysteries of the higher planes of existence, of which even its dogmas and superstitions are crude hints and indications. What science does for our knowledge of the material world, replacing first experience, pardon me, replacing first appearances and uses by the hidden truths and as yet occult powers of its great natural forces, and in our own minds, beliefs and opinions by verified experience and a profounder understanding, yoga does for the higher planes and worlds and possibilities of our being, which are aimed at by the religions. Ah, so this is the great inner science, to practice yoga. Become yourself, the experiment, and the experimenter. Therefore, all this mass of graded experience existing behind closed doors, to which the consciousness of man may find, if it wills, the key, falls within the province of a comprehensive yoga of knowledge, which need not be confined to the seeking after the absolute alone, or the knowledge of the divine in itself, or of the divine only in its isolated relations with the individual human soul. So this is the great yoga of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna, as Purushottama, invites Arjuna to come and know him not only in the depths of his essence, but in all the ways, all the principles of his existence. And then you have something. Then you come to my highest nature. You don't simply dwell in the ordinary prakriti. You live in para prakriti. And there, see me give birth to all the jivas. Watch me multiply nature endlessly. It is a majestic experience, and it is available to the aspirant. It is true that the consciousness of the Absolute is the highest reach of the yoga of knowledge, and that the possession of the divine is its first, greatest, and most ardent object, and that to neglect it for an inferior knowledge is to afflict our yoga with inferiority or even frivolity, and to miss or fall away from its characteristic object. But the divine, in itself being known, the yoga of knowledge may well embrace also the knowledge of the divine in its relations with ourselves and the world on the different planes of our existence. He says it again. Consciousness of the Absolute, Chit, Chit Shakti, possession of the divine, Sat. And thus, because Sat is a deliberate act to distribute the one existence into many forms so that it can experience itself like that, we return implicitly to the unifying chord of Sat-Chit-Ananda, the three notes which are always one. To rise to the pure self, being steadfastly held to as the summit of our subjective self-uplifting, we may from that height possess our lower selves, even to the physical and the workings of nature which belong to them, which would be an integral knowledge, where we would bring the knowledge of the spirit down to the lowest compass of its own self-extended being, excluding nothing, therefore harmonizing all in one being, the integer, the only one who exists, the omnipresent divine, the life divine, hinges on this realization being made concrete. This is a rather short chapter, and we're going to place a bookmark there, and we'll continue this next week. Here's a section in Savitri, Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 3, the Entry into the Inner Countries. I think it's relevant. Life was consigned to a safe level path. It dared not tempt the great and difficult heights, or climb to be neighbor to a lonely star, or skirt the danger of the precipice, or tempt the foam-curled breaker's perilous laugh, adventure's lyrist, danger's amateur, or into her chamber call some flaming god, or leave the world's bounds, and where no limits are, meet with the heart's passion the adorable, or set the world ablaze with the inner fire. A chastened epithet in the prose of life, she must fill with color just her sanctioned space, not break out of the cabin of the idea, nor trespass into rhythms too high or vast. Even when it soared into ideal air, thought's flight lost not itself in heaven's blue. It drew upon the skies a patterned flower of disciplined beauty and harmonic light. A temperate, vigilant spirit governed life. Its acts were tools of the considering thought, too cold to take fire and set the world ablaze, or the careful reasons, diplomatic moves, testing the means to a prefigured end, or at the highest pitch, some calm will's plan, or a strategy of some high command within, to conquer the secret treasures of the gods, or win for a masked king some glorious world, not a reflex of the spontaneous self, an index of the being and its moods, a winging of conscious spirit, a sacrament of life's communion with the still supreme, or its pure movement on the eternal's road. Or else for the body of some high idea, a house was built with two close-fitting bricks. Action and thought cemented, made a wall of small ideals limiting the soul. Even meditation mused on a narrow seat. And worship turned to an exclusive god, to the universal in a chapel prayed whose doors were shut against the universe, or kneeled to the bodiless impersonal, a mind shut to the cry and fire of love. A rational religion dried the heart. It planned a smooth life's acts with ethics rule, or offered a cold and flameless sacrifice. The sacred book lay on its sanctified desk, wrapped in interpretation's silken strings. A credo sealed up its spiritual sense. Well, we shall not be engrossed in the world's external design, and that is not for us. Let us break free. Soar! You Paramahansa, you. You great being. You can't fool us. We know who you are. Listen, thank you for being here. Love to you all. I look forward to seeing you again soon. Namaste. Jai Ma.